This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
the fact that General Haftar and the Libyan National Army have taken the oil ports means there's going to be a rebalancing of political power across Libya. So now that Haftar essentially has control of the oil, not only is it a very symbolic...
That's Rhiannon Smith, Managing Director of Libya Analysis. She comments on a military takeover of Libyan oil ports. Details coming up.
Also in Zambia, President Edgar Lungu took the oath of office today after the nation's high court rejected a petition to postpone the ceremony. Police in Zimbabwe have once again imposed a ban on anti-government demonstrations, and many of those 2.5 million people displaced by war between Nigeria's military and Boko Haram militants still have no access to food and medical care.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, in Zambia, President Edgar Lungu took the oath of office today after the nation's high court rejected a petition to postpone the ceremony. The political opposition had claimed there were voting irregularities in a close runoff election on August 11th. Opposition candidate Hakainde Hichilema had filed the charge when electoral officials declared Mr. Lungu the winner with just over 50% of the vote. Mr. Lungu also defeated Hichilema in 2014 when he was elected to his first five-year term after the death of President Michael Sata.
Also, police in Zimbabwe have once again imposed a ban on anti-government demonstrations. The move follows a court decision last week which struck down a two-week police ban on protests. Despite that, police responded today by imposing a new month-long prohibition against demonstrations. AFP reports police took the action shortly after an opposition party coalition announced today it would stage mass rallies across the country on Saturday. Organizers say they will defy the police ban.
Also, Zimbabwe's political opposition is evolving. For many years, the main resistance to the government of President Robert Mugabe and his ruling ZANU-PF party came from the Movement for Democratic Change. New social movements opposed to the government have recently gained popularity. They include #ThisFlag and #Tajamuka, which means we are agitated. Tendai Biti is a constitutional lawyer, former finance minister, and leader of the New People's Democratic Party. VOA's William Eagle asked him about his party's relationship with this new social media movement.
Our movement, the PDP, is a young political party. The average age in our party is 21 years. So we are part and parcel of the #movement. #Tajamuka, #ThisFlag, #Sesijikile, #ThisFlower, #ThisHand. We are part and parcel of that, and that's the future of this country. 65% of our population are below the age of 35. That's the future. That is why I'm making the point that we are in a transition that is both demographic, some would even say technological. The #generation has found power through the instrumentality of a weapon of mass destruction called the smartphone, and through Twitter, through Facebook, through Instagram. The revolution is being waged. And contrary to Scott Heron in 1968, this revolution will be televised. This revolution is being digitalized. And that's fact.
Some have suggested that the opposition should form a coalition to unseat Mr. Mugabe. Of course, it's been tried in the past. And we're talking now about the new order and the new generation. Are you confident that within the next couple of years you will be successful? And are you even successful today? And joining all of these movements, some of them are disparate. It's not just the MDC. It's many different parties, including your party. Are you confident that all of the many forms of opposition in Zimbabwe today can indeed coalesce and form a unity movement, a coalition movement?
Look, I'm not a marabout or a prophet, so I can't say it is going to happen definitively. But as I was trying to say, the convergence is already beginning, is already in place. So you have 12 parties that are nearer the national electoral reform agenda. You have got 10 or so parties that are in court, the Coalition for Democrats. These parties, in the last few weeks, they've been able to work together. On the 26th of August, there was a demonstration in Zimbabwe led by NERA and other and CORD and other political parties. So I have no doubt in my mind that a convergence is going to take place. The only question is whether we are all going to converge in one coalition block, or there will be two coalition blocks, which obviously is not in the best interest of Zimbabwe, as it will just favor ZANU-PF. So people are beginning to understand the importance and inevitability of convergence. And it's not just convergence amongst the political parties. It's also necessary and essential that the nascent social movement, represented by the hashtag movement, also converges with the political movement. Because the hashtag movement, the nascent social movement, has got short-term demands, immediate demands, I would argue populist demands. Those short-term demands are important because they make our people angry. They are a source of mobilization. But they must marry with the long-term demands of political parties, which are demanding long-term sustainable change and transformation in this country.
That was Tendai Biti, a constitutional lawyer and leader of the People's Democratic Party in Zimbabwe.
Two and a half million people have been displaced by the seven-year war between the Nigerian military and Boko Haram militants, and many of them still have no access to food and medical care. There are increasing cases of severe acute malnutrition and polio, but Gada Hatim of the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders says the list of health problems is growing longer. From Abuja, she talked to VOA's David Arnold.
There is a high increase in the number of patients coming to our clinics. Main diseases, diarrhea, upper respiratory infections, and malaria. Malaria is really on the rise, and we can see an increase of 94% compared to previous weeks.
I'd heard about polio and malnutrition. This is an added health problem.
Yes, the rainy season has started, and it's expected. What's also expected is an outbreak of cholera. If this happens, then we are definitely dealing with a completely different scenario. We're still at alarming rate of 15% of severe acute malnutrition and 40% of moderate malnutrition.
What kind of situation did you say you face if we do not respond more effectively now?
Worsening figures in malnutrition, people dying because of hunger.
Do you have any idea what the morbidity rates are now?
Because we are in our own figures from our own clinics, we don't have an overall picture. So the overall picture we don't have, but figures from our own health facilities are worrisome. Considering failure of three harvesting seasons in 3 years in a row, dependent community and IDP settings, 100% on external relief, difficult to access some areas, we may face a worsening situation. We are seeing serious figures on malnutrition. This is what I can confirm, yes. It is decreasing, but given the situation or the fact that these population are depending on external aid, this aid needs to be sustainable, systematic, and of quality.
Who is providing that external relief?
NEMA, this is the National Emergency Management Committee, and SEMA, which is at the state level. And then you have all the international organizations, including UN agencies and non-governmental organizations like MSF and ICRC and other organizations as well. Majority are in Borno State, but also in Yobe, which also had been affected, and Adamawa State. The epicenter of the population movement displacement and needs remain to be in Borno State.
For many years, Boko Haram has been fighting there with the military, but the reports were that the military had cleared Boko Haram out of most of those areas, and yet is it still difficult to get access to all three northeastern regions?
Some locations and destinations can be accessed, but yet we're cautious because any attack could happen. other destinations cannot be accessed unless we are under military escort. Other areas cannot be accessed at all, like around Lake Chad, Ngala, and Ran. These areas, still there is no any humanitarian organization that managed to access over there.
And why is there no access to that Lake Chad area?
Because either there is still ongoing operation or insurgency activity. It's a bit complicated. Different organizations are considering the option of accessing through Comorian borders. It's the same way NSF today is accessing population trapped in Banki, which we are accessing them through Cameroon.
That was Gada Hatim of Doctors Without Borders from the Nigerian capital Abuja. She spoke to VOA's David Arnold.
Sixteen minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Well, Germany has arrested three suspected Islamic State militants who were found carrying forged Syrian passports. AFP reports police say they belong to a possible sleeper cell with links to the Paris attackers. More than 200 police commandos took part in pre-dawn raids in northern Germany. Police say the three suspects left Syria last October. Then they traveled through Turkey and on to Greece, a route used by tens of thousands of refugees in recent years. That route has been mostly closed since March due to an agreement between the EU and Turkey.
France, Germany, Italy, Spain have joined the United States to call on Libyan military leader Khalifa Haftar to withdraw his forces from oil terminals on the coast. General Haftar is allied with a rival government in Tobruk, which has not yet taken a vote to support the government of national accord in Tripoli. Haftar's forces captured three oil terminals over the weekend from a militia popularly known as the Petroleum Facilities Guard. Western diplomats seek to restore control of the terminals to the National Unity Government headed by Faiz El-Sarj. However, it has been struggling to gain full control of the country. Rhiannon Smith is managing director of Libya Analysis. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi asked her about the consequences of Haftar's takeover of the Libyan oil ports.
The fact that General Haftar and the Libyan National Army have taken the oil ports means there's going to be a rebalancing of political power across Libya. So now that Haftar essentially has control of the oil, not only is it a very symbolic rebalancing of power showing that actually Haftar has more control than the government of National Accord, it also means that he has the potential to make money from those oil revenues. In reality, however, it's unlikely in the near future that he will be able to export any oil. So actually this is more of a strategic move to A, to sort of weaken the GNA and show that they don't have control and to prevent them from exporting any oil. In reality, the NOC still has force majeure on most of, other than Brega, on all of the other oil ports in the region. And in order for them to lift that, they need to do repairs, and the GNA currently controls the budget for that. So that's unlikely to happen given the statement the GNA has released saying that, you know, they don't recognise this move and they condemn it and stuff. But it does mean, like I say, there'll be a shift in power now. I mean, Haftar has more control over the territory. It also means in the eyes of the Libyan people, you know, they've got a lot more power on the ground and they've got a lot more leverage to sort of demand what they want from the UN and from the GNA and other factions within Libya.
The United States and Western powers issued a joint statement condemning the military takeover of the ports and threatened to enforce measures to punish individuals and entities threatening the unity of Libya. Would that sway General Haftar?
It's unlikely to sway General Haftar. These type of threats and sanctions have been made before and nothing much has come of them, particularly against Haftar. And from Haftar's point of view, this move is part of his plan to get more control over the whole of Libya. And this will, A, make a spoiler for any further negotiations in favour of the GNA. And it gives him a lot greater control over large areas of eastern Libya, gives him control of the oil fields, and the fact that he's taken them over so swiftly is going to give him a lot more credibility and legitimacy within Libya. And therefore, the sort of opinion and the threats from the international community are unlikely to sway him or to change what he's doing.
So what should the international community do to avoid a new armed conflict in Libya?
This is a difficult one. The main thing here, I think the main sort of lesson or thing to bear in mind is to get a political solution before having any sort of military intervention. So in the case of the US and some of the other European governments have got some forces involved in Libya, either on the ground or in airstrikes against the Islamic State. Those forces, some are actually on the side of Haftar, some are on the Mizratan side, which are aligned with the GNA. And it could conceivably be now, if Mizratan managed to defeat ISIS in Sirte, which is quite likely, they could then potentially form a new front against Haftar between sort of east and west. And there, the sort of international community is almost on both side. So I think the GNA is losing a lot of credibility and a lot of legitimacy within Libya because it's lacking control, it hasn't got the social base, it hasn't got the political support because of all the internal divisions. And therefore, I think the international community needs to have a coherent strategy to try and restart negotiations from almost from a new slate. I think the Libyan political agreement, as it's got to now, is not getting very far. It's not solving the conflicts that are going on in Libya, so I think they need to rethink the GNA and try and involve all sides to try and get a political solution or an outline of one involving the oil and things before starting to do anything militarily within the country.
Rhiannon Smith is Managing Director of Libya Analysis. She spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy.
A new report reveals the brutal, dangerous, and sometimes illegal animal trapping practices common on private, public, and protected lands. The latest Born Free USA undercover operation conducted in upstate New York and in rural southwest Iowa reveals trappers get setting cruel, indiscriminate, and sometimes illegal traps. The trapping operations are fueled by the global demand for fur. Adam M. Roberts is CEO of the International Animal Welfare and Wildlife Conservation Organization, Born Free USA. He spoke with me about what he describes as a callous disregard for wildlife, public safety, and the law, and what is being done to stop it.
This recent investigation that we've just released from Born Free USA is actually the second that we've done. We did the first one 5 years ago, and we really wanted to see if there was trapping still going on both public and private lands around the country, including trapping using some of the most brutal devices, including the steel jaw leg hole trap and conner bear trap. So we got with these undercover investigators to go out on the trap line and really see what was happening so that we were able to better paint an accurate picture both for the American public and importantly for members of Congress as to what trapping looks like. So when they're considering legislation to end this cruel practice, they have a real sense of the barbarity involved.
Where did this particular undercover investigation take place?
We had investigators go out on two different trap lines, one in the state of Iowa and one in New York, in Adirondack Park in New York. And in each individual place, there was some similarities in what they found, but also some distinctions in terms of the species being trapped and the methodology used in the trapping.
You describe your finding as being very shocking. So can you tell us what you did discover?
Yeah, so I would say there were sort of two things that really stand out to me personally and professionally in terms of the shocking nature of the findings. One is in relation to the use of conner bear traps and beavers, specifically in New York, where the trapper would actually destroy a beaver's dam, knowing that the animals would return and try and rebuild the structure. And so when they destroy the dam, they actually put this wall of death, these multiple conner bear traps in the water where the dam was, and the animal comes in to try and rebuild the dam, and then the conner bear trap is supposed to, if it works the way it's supposed to, snap on the neck of the animal, resulting in a rather quick death. But instead, in this instance, we found conner bear traps slamming on the animal's abdomen, meaning the animal suffocated and drowned as a result of that trapping incident. So that was particularly cruel and barbaric. barbaric from my estimation. But perhaps even more gruesome was what we found in Iowa, where steel jaw leg hold traps were set out to catch coyotes, and that resulted in prolonged suffering for the distressed animal, trapped, tethered to the ground, couldn't move, writhing in pain. And then ultimately, we have video footage that anyone can see at bornforusa.org, where the trapper actually kicks the animal rather hard in the animal's side, and when she falls over, it's only then that the footage ends, because that's when the trapper shoots her in the lungs. The lungs then fill with blood, and the animal suffocates and dies. So it is really compelling footage, but obviously very difficult to watch, and shows the real brutality involved in the trapping industry.
Yes, it does sound horribly brutal. So then what do they do with these animals once they have been killed this way?
Well, you know, the real interesting thing that I find about trapping is that the trapping industry in America, the more than 4 million animals in the wild that are trapped to provide fur for the fur trade, it's really not about commerce. People aren't actually making their livelihoods from trapping. They're doing it for so-called sport or recreation, and then ultimately selling the furs as a byproduct of that activity. So these animals will be trapped and then ultimately skinned, which is obviously gruesome, and then the animal's flesh and body parts are discarded to sell the fur onto the commercial market.
What is the next step after this type of exposure?
Well, you know, at Born Free, we definitely believe in turning this kind of information into action, and there are multiple efforts before the United States Congress, again, all of which will be outlined on our website so that anybody who listens can weigh in to try and stop this kind of cruel activity in America.
Sometimes it does take a while to get a bill passed. In the meantime, is there anything else that can be done to try to stop this type of killing?
There are things that American consumers can definitely do. Obviously, never buy fur, and especially don't buy things that have fur trim. You know, a lot of people think that somehow if it's just a little bit of fur, it's not as brutal for the animals, but of course we know that's not the case. And then encourage retailers to go fur free. If there are department stores or other stores that are selling fur, please urge those department store managers to stop selling fur. And also, Born Free has a Fur for the Animals campaign, where if people have old furs that they've either had for years or were handed down to them by family members, they can send those furs to Born Free's Washington office, and we'll actually repurpose them to comfort wild animals in need at wildlife rehabilitation centers across the country. So people can definitely take action. Once they've let Congress know that they want Congress to act, they can act in their own daily lives as well.
Adam M. Roberts is CEO of the International Animal Welfare and Wildlife Conservation, Born Free USA. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Tuesday on Health Chat, Hosley Normadou will discuss malaria research breakthroughs with her guest, Professor Kelly Shibali, researcher, University of Cape Town. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth one-on-one conversation with Namibian President. The wide-ranging discussion will include the President's vision for the future of the Southern African nation. That's next, right here on Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.